Very good. Shall we begin?
Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
Let's recite a few sutras where we currently are in the text. We'll begin with 51, Anirvachaniyam. Sutra 51, repeat after me.
Anirvachaniyam, Anirvachaniyam, Prema Swarupam, Mukha Swaranavat, Prakashate, Kvapi Patre, Gunarahitam, Kamanarahitam, Pratikshana Vardhamanam, Avichinnam, Sukshmataram, Anubhavarupam, Tat Prapya, Tadevavalokayati, Tadeva Shrinoti, Tadeva Chintayati, Gauni Tridha, Guna Bhedat, Artadi Bhedatva, Uttarasmat, Uttarasmat, Purva Purva Shreyaya Bhavati, Anyasmat, Saulabhyam Bhaktau, Pramanantarasya, Anapekshatvat, Swayam Pramanatvacha, Shanti Rupatvat, Paramananda Rupacha.
Very good. In this section of the Bhakti Sutra, we continue to focus more on the sadhana bhakti as opposed to the sadhya bhakti. That is, bhakti as a means as opposed to bhakti as a goal. But you know, the sutra style is a little peculiar. It's a technical rendering of a subject matter. One of the things that's always done in any technical rendering is you make lists. I never studied botany, but I some of you may have, and I understand botany is just list after list after list, genome, phyla, species, this group, that group, the other group. It goes on and on and on. You can imagine studying a bunch of beautiful flowers. Well, what will a botanist do but assign these beautiful flowers to one or the other of all these complicated categories? So you might wonder then, if your goal is to appreciate beautiful flowers, why study botany? In a way, the study of botany could actually rob you, possibly, could rob you of the enjoyment of flowers. Because instead of smelling the flower, instead of enjoying the flower, instead of arranging the flowers or whatever you like to do with them, what are you doing? You are classifying flowers. Now, classifying flowers doesn't sound like a very aesthetic experience by any means. In fact, it sounds basically pretty dull and boring. But as a preliminary, do you think it's possible that the study of botany could allow you to enjoy flowers even more deeply? I would imagine that a botanist will see subtleties of a flower that you and I would never see, because they're trained to look for those subtleties. Now, if you ask, what does that botanical classification got to do with enjoying flowers? Absolutely nothing. I agree. I'd be the first to agree with you. On the other hand, it still has a role, a possible role. This text falls into the same category as that botany book. This text classifies forms of bhakti. And what do you get out of classifying forms of bhakti? Pretty much the same as you get out of classifying kinds of flowers. It gives you a structure in your head. That much and that much only. Now, that's not enough. On the other hand, it's clearly helpful. Especially, just a quick observation here, those of us in this room, we all tend to have lots of education, lots of years of college and schooling. And that trains us to think in a certain way. It trains us to, I don't know about you, but speaking for myself, I feel myself more comfortable if I know the structure first. Then I can kind of find my way around as we proceed. That's the nature of this text. So as we go on classifying bhakti, as we will in today's class, let us not make the mistake that this is some kind of dry, boring study. And it could be, of course, if we allow it to be. But rather, can we think of it a little bit like for the botanist? It's empowering us with the knowledge of a structure. Knowing this structure, hopefully we can immerse ourselves much more deeply in whatever it is, in this case, too, in bhakti. So with that brief introduction, we continue to talk about bhakti and classifications. I guess the reason for that introduction is we have more classifications. We've already been distinguishing between parabhakti and aparabhakti. We've been classifying, separating between sadhya bhakti and sadhana bhakti. Are you ready for more? Because we break it down even further here. If we take the category, we've already said there's sadhya bhakti and sadhana. Then under the category of sadhana bhakti, we have some subcategories, two in particular, which we will call mukhya, which means, let me do it in Roman here, mukhya, or primary, and gauni, which will translate as secondary. I can't even spell. Let's try again. Secondary. All right. So we have A, B, A sadhya, B sadhana. Then we have mukhya and gauni. And guess what comes next? Sure. We'll see this maybe a little later. So we're going to get into then subclassifications. In fact, three subclassifications of gauni. We'll see that a little bit later in the class. So again, this is not bhakti. Arguably, this has very little to do with bhakti. We're classifying bhakti like classifying flowers. Hopefully, though, having the structure will help us understand and help us appreciate more, go deeper. All right. So now we can pick up the thread. And we finished Sutra 53 in a prior class. As we continue tonight, we're continuing 54, is talking about now mukhya bhakti. So we're talking sadhana bhakti now. Our discussion of sadhya bhakti is over. But now in the sadhana bhakti, we're going to discuss first this mukhya sadhana bhakti, this primary means for what? the primary means for getting para bhakti. All right, enough said. Sutra 54. What is mukhya bhakti? Guna rahitam. Kamana rahitam. Pratikshana vardhamanam. Avichinnam. Sukshmataram. Anubhava rupam. So, how to describe mukhya bhakti, the primary means to gain parama bhakti? Well, we should understand what it is. And he gives a description here. Leave the first word apart, because the first word, guna rahitam, is a tricky one. We'll see that one last. So what is this mukhya bhakti? What kind of bhakti? What do you mean bhakti? Well, we talked before about three levels of love, kama, prema, and bhakti. And so he says clearly it is kamana rahitam. It is free from any desire, free from lust, free from a selfish agenda, free from wanting for oneself. It is pratikshana vardhamanam, always growing. We're going to come back to that also. Avichinnam, uninterrupted, we talked about before. Sukshmataram, extremely subtle. Extremely subtle means what? So far this is ending up looking like a very nebulous definition. And nebulous definition is vague, imprecise definitions just don't help us much. The key, and what's the really tricky word in the sutra, is guna rahitam. Free from qualities. Rahita means without. Here, without guna, without qualities, without characteristics. Bhakti is without characteristics? What kind of definition is that? It's a little bit like defining a cat by saying, well, it doesn't have any dogness, doesn't have any cowness, doesn't have any houseness. That is, you define it as being free from these contrary attributes. But this doesn't say free from certain contrary attributes. For example, kamana rahitam means free from one thing. Kamana, desire, selfish need. But this says guna rahitam. Guna is a very general word. All kinds of qualities, all kinds of attributes. How can bhakti, again, mukhya bhakti, how can it be free from all kinds of attributes? I think without a Vedantic interpretation, I don't know how you'd get any sense out of this. It seems to me that Vedanta is essential. The teaching techniques of Vedanta are essential to really getting the meaning out of this. In Vedanta, we talk a lot about nirguna. We talk a lot about negation in Vedanta. Those of you, most of you have been attending our Vedanta classes. And you may have heard me say that Vedanta is nishedha para. Vedanta is primarily in the form of negation. You've all heard neti, neti, na iti, na iti, not this, not this, not this. Vedanta is primarily a system of negation. You say, what will you get out of that? Or to make a bad joke, you know, in modern American English, if somebody is complaining a lot, then somebody will say, oh, you're being so negative. Why are you being so negative? Well, Vedanta is nothing but negative. It says you're not this, you're not that, you're not this, you're not that. So what do you get out of being so negative? How can that possibly work to make you discover fullness and freedom? Most of you can already answer that question, and that is, you already are what you want to become. You already have what you want to possess. That vast reservoir of love and compassion is already here now as your true divine nature. It just happens to be obstructed. And whatever obstructs the manifestation of that Atma Swarupa, one's true nature, whatever stands in the way of that Atma-sarupa expressing itself in your thoughts, in your emotions, in your activities, in your life, all of those obstructions are negated. That is what Vedanta is about. Removing all those obstructions. The primary obstruction, according to Advaita Vedanta, being avidya, ignorance. So, negation, 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 negation. Now, in a prior class, we also talked about negation of ahankara, ego. And what a tricky subject that is. I think it was two classes ago, we spent most of a class talking about negation of ahankara, if I remember right. We don't want to get into the long, we want to keep with this flow of sutras. But bear in mind, what is it that keeps you separate from Bhagavan? If bhakti, and just to recapture the essence, the sara of that class, we said, in fact, it was our last class, wasn't it? We said, kama is a union of two bodies, prema is a union of two minds, and bhakti is a union. Of course, atma is already non-separate from paramatma, but loosely speaking, it is the union of atma and paramatma. We said it's like the wave and the water. The wave is already non-separate from, wave and ocean. The wave is already non-separate from the ocean. But if the wave doesn't know it's non-separate from the ocean, the wave could see itself as this finite little wave. As long as this wave sees itself as finite, as isolated, as separate, for that length of time, the wave will not see that it's non-separate from the ocean. In the same way, so long as you identify with your body, mind, and senses, you will not be able to discover your non-separation from Bhagavan. What will it take for the wave to recognize its non-separation from the ocean? Well, when it stops identifying as being this limited wave. When the wave loses its ahankara, its sense of individuality. In the same way, when will you cease to experience yourself as finite, as limited, as separate from Bhagavan? When your ahankara, your ego, eventually gets negated. So, how can, all of this is build up, negation, negation, negation. So, negation of ignorance, negation of ego. What is being negated here? Guna rahitam, he says bhakti is the absence of gunas, so something has been negated to get rid of the gunas. Gunas belong to whom? Guna means quality, attributes, characteristics. Body has gunas, mind has gunas, senses have gunas, sthula sharira has gunas, sukshma sharira has gunas, atma has no guna, nirguna, satchidananda, just consciousness, limitless, boundaryless, uncreated, unchanging consciousness, no qualities. So, when you negate everything else, what's left has no qualities. What's left is satchidananda atma. Now, how does that connect to bhakti? Because this kind of negation is very, very usually associated with Advaita Vedanta. We don't see any scope for it in bhakti. Where's the connection to bhakti? We made a little reference to that, I think, in a previous class. Prapatti, surrender. Surrender means what? Ultimately, surrender means you give up. Prapatti means surrender. And the ultimate expression of surrender in this bhakti tradition is to surrender. To surrender yourself means what? You can't. Who's surrendering what? Ultimately, surrender ends up being another way of understanding ahankara nasha, destruction of ahankara, loss of ahankara. From one perspective, we can call it getting rid of the ego, ahankara. From the other perspective, we can call it surrender or prapatti. They end up being the same thing. Interesting that different traditions will take very different approaches here. The tradition of Advaita Vedanta never talks about prapatti, only talks about this ahankara nasha, destroying the ego. This, some of you know this Vishishta Advaita tradition, or even the Dvaita traditions of Vedanta, they're also Vedantic traditions, focus more on bhakti. They never talk about ahankara nasha, but they certainly do talk about prapatti, surrender. So here's a little suggestion. If in the future you ever do a comparative study of Advaita Vedanta together with Vishishta Advaita or Dvaita, the traditions of Ramanuja and the traditions of Madhva, if you ever do a comparative study, look for the connection. What the Advaitins call ahankara nasha, destruction of ego, is exactly the same as what the Vishishta Advaitins call prapatti, or the Advaitins call prapatti, surrender. So, talking about now mukhya bhakti, the primary bhakti, the primary means to gain parabhakti is what? It is guna rahita, free from qualities, meaning this bhakti must be a state of surrender, complete surrender. Surrender means I am not. Now, in that expression, I am not, which I is not. We use the word I in so many ways. Sometimes I refers to the physical body. Sometimes I refers to the mind, to the personality. Sometimes I refers to Satchidananda Atma, consciousness. In the expression, I am not, it really is a negation, ultimately, of the ego, the sense of being an individual. There is a body. There is a mind. But to take yourself as a conscious entity separate from God, that conclusion is based on an idea, and the idea is wrong. When you free yourself from the idea, you free yourself from the sense of isolation, just like the wave. When the wave, as long as a wave identifies itself, I am a wave, eka tarangaha, one wave, I am this wave, I am a wave. As long as he identifies himself as a wave, he'll experience himself as being separate, isolated from the ocean. When he can finally say, hey, I'm not a wave. After all, there's only water. With that recognition, notice a wave form remains. What really goes away is this ahankara, this, or even better to say, this identification is what finally falls away. The false identification with what you're not. When the wave stops identifying itself with the wave shape, it is freed from that sense of isolation. When you cease to identify with body, mind, and senses, this is a freedom from isolation. This is the ultimate meaning of prapatti, surrender. And in this way, that mukhya bhakti is guna rahitam. That word is tricky, isn't it? If you're just reading, if you're just going through these sutras and say bhakti is free from qualities, what? So the only way, I believe, the only way to make sense out of this particular sutra is with this very Vedantic kind of approach. See it as negation. Negation, in this case, of ego, of identification. So, mukhya bhakti is guna rahitam, free from qualities. Why? It's negation of self. Remember the language that the great bhaktas used, and the language usually goes, More of me means less of him. Him referring to Bhagavan. The more my ego is in the way, the more I walk around saying, I did it, look who I am, watch me, see what I'm doing. So more of me means less of Bhagavan. Conversely, less of me, more of him, then none of me, only him. This is how surrender works. It's almost too simple. To the extent that your ego is built up and you identify with your body, mind, sense complex, that very identification holds you separate from Bhagavan. The way to be one with God, so to speak, is only to gradually weaken that ego, to let go. So less of me, more of him. Finally, none of me, only him. That's the culmination. So that's the culmination. That's ultimately parabhakti. All right, let's finish this up. Mukhya bhakti then is gunarahitam. It's free from qualities because it is the absence of ego, absence of identification with the body and mind. It is kamanarahitam, we said before, free from any selfish need or lust or desire. Pratikshana vardhamanam. Surrender. How can bhakti always grow? That's what it says. Pratikshana. Every moment, it is vardhamana, growing, expanding. In a state of surrender, suppose what you found was so blissful. Actually, that comes a little bit later. Suppose what you found in a prayerful sense of self-surrender, what you found was so blissful, getting rid of yourself. What an odd expression. Getting rid of yourself is blissful. Kind of interesting. We generally think that in order to experience bliss and happiness, we have to be present. We have to use our minds and senses, after all, to enjoy anything, to enjoy ananda, to enjoy bliss. Turns out to be absolutely the opposite. And a good way of seeing this is in almost any form of meditation. Just to make a connection to meditation techniques. Consider this fact. When you're meditating, any form of meditation that you might practice, have you noticed that the quieter your mind becomes, the better you feel? That's simple, right? It's very intuitive. The more active your mind is, the more you don't feel what you want to feel. But the quieter your mind becomes in meditation, you have that sense of moving closer and closer to what you want. You have that sense of satisfaction to the extent your mind becomes quiet. What is the message here? If the quieter your mind becomes, the more bliss you feel, then the quietest mind is the maximum bliss and contentment. And what's counterintuitive about this is we generally assume we have to use our minds for the sake of experiencing bliss and gaining contentment in life. But look at the conclusion we just drew. If we think that we have to always use our minds to get some happiness out of life, maybe we've got it backwards. As we just said, in the practice of meditation, you can discover that to the extent that your mind becomes quiet, to that extent you enjoy contentment, peace, happiness. So the condition of surrender is like that meditation. It's a state of letting go. It's a state of simplicity, a state of quietude, and in that condition, you discover how desirable it is. And there's one thing we all do very well, and that is we pursue whatever we like. This is true in every avenue of life. It's true at the dinner table, you pursue, or the restaurant, you pursue what you like. It's true when it comes to recreation or anything else. It's true at maybe at in a workplace, you're drawn towards jobs that you like. It's true. It's true in coming here this evening. You came here, you could have done many other things this evening. So you're drawn here today because you like this kind of study. You find it helpful, I presume. We're drawn towards that which we like. In the same way, when you start off meditating, it's not very rewarding. It's frustrating. It's difficult. To discipline the mind is difficult. But when you get the hang of it a little bit, when you start to develop that skill of meditation, then your mind becomes quiet and it really feels good. You like it. Well, if you like it, guess what? You'll do it more. And the more you do it, the better you become. The better you become, the more blissful it is. The more blissful it is, the more you like it. The more you like it, the more you pursue it. And this is, I guess in science or engineering, this is our positive feedback. The more you do it, the more rewarding it is. It draws you in. This works in meditation. This works in bhakti. But there's a hump you have to get over. The first time you sit and meditate, you may not like it. It may be hard. It may be frustrating. Your mind goes on wandering, wandering, wandering. But in order to get over the hump, in order to develop the love for it, it's going to take some effort on your part. Bhakti is no different. The first time, I think we gave this example long ago. First time you do puja, what comes? You do this, and you wonder, why am I doing this? You know, these are some mechanical actions, what am I doing? And then you have to make sure you don't get mixed up and start, you have to keep it all straight. So you find it awkward and clumsy, I think, in a prior class. I admitted that when I started performing puja at the beginning, it felt very artificial, it felt very clumsy, it felt awkward, it felt silly. But you have to get over the hump. Just as in meditation, the first time you sit and meditate, I doubt you're going to go into deep samadhi. You'll probably struggle a lot with your mind wandering, but if you persist, you can really develop a beautiful practice of meditation. In the same way, the first time you do puja or any other expression of bhakti, you go sing some kirtan or whatever, it's fun in the ISKCON temples. They like to dance. So you can imagine going to, just for fun, imagine going to one of these temples, and they're all dancing. You're watching them dance. They're going back and forth. And they have this interesting style of jumping. Jump, jump. Hare Krishna, jump. Hare Rama, jump. Now, please, I'm not making fun of it. These people are really sincere. They're really intense. Suppose you're watching them dancing and jumping, and you think that's silly. But then suppose I'm next to you. I say, come on, give it a try. Just try. See what happens. Then you start dancing and jumping. And how will you feel? Ridiculous. At least initially. You'll feel silly. You'll feel, why am I dancing and jumping around? What is this all about? If you persist a little longer, it's kind of infectious. Because all the other devotees are so intense, they're really into it, they're really enjoying it. It rubs off. My guess is if you start dancing, at first it'll feel awkward, you dance a little bit more, it'll start to work for you. Eventually you could become an ardent devotee, singing and dancing and jumping along with the rest of them. This is how bhakti is cultivated. That's why. Pratikshana vartamanam, always growing, always increasing. Once you really discover the essence of it, the sara of it, then it'll continue growing. This bhakti is also avichinnam. We discussed this before. Unbroken, uninterrupted. And we then, when we discussed this, we used this word avichinna to distinguish this from a mere passing emotion. Emotions come and go. We're describing a state of surrender. And if surrender comes and goes, what kind of surrender is that? Surrender means you can't, if you give, yesterday was Christmas Day. Many people give presents on Christmas. So when you give a present, you functionally surrender the present to the other person. You give it. You surrender the present. Good. Do you take it back the next day? What's surrendered stays surrendered. Emotions don't stay. Emotions come and go. Even emotions, devotional feelings can come and go. But this mukhya bhakti, as we said before, is not merely an emotion. It involves emotions, definitely. It involves emotions. But it's not merely an emotion. All right. Then, finishing up our definition of mukhya bhakti, it is sukshma taram. Sukshma, subtle. Sukshma tara, more subtle, extremely subtle. Subtle is another one of those words where it could be very vague. Jet lag. I know that. It's jet lag. So sukshmatara could mean extremely subtle. Extremely subtle could be a very vague word. Here it has a very precise meaning. That which has no gunas is real subtle. Subtle means you can't describe it. Subtle means you can't experience it. Subtle means you can't get your hands around it. Of course not. It has no qualities. It's not there. It's an absence. What could be more subtle than an absence? Like, here's a pen in my hand. Pretty obvious. But you want to see something very subtle is the pen in this hand. Extremely subtle because there's nothing there. So nothing can be more subtle than nothing. All right. Sukshma taram, most subtle. And anubhava rupam. This mukhya bhakti is one whose rupa, whose form is anubhava, it's experience. It's not separate from your experience. Careful now. Just because it says anubhava rupa, it's in the form of experience. The moment a word like that comes, then some people will think, oh, I have to experience that. Please tell me, how can I experience that mukhya bhakti? It says anubhava rupa. I want that anubhava. I want that experience. Well, most of you have figured out the problem here. You're already having the experience. Bhagavan is already present in this experience. If you want Bhagavan's darshana, where do you have to go to see Bhagavan? You know very well. There's no reason to go anywhere. Bhagavan is present here now, available for discovery here now. Therefore, we could even argue, what is the need of going to a temple? Well, if you can see Bhagavan everywhere, and Bhagavan is indeed everywhere, then there's no need of going to a temple. Does that mean we should get rid of all of our mandirs? Certainly not. Why? Suppose you can't see Bhagavan everywhere, like most people cannot. Then isn't it helpful, at least, that you have a temple where you can see and feel Bhagavan's presence on the altar? If you can't, put it this way. if you cannot feel Bhagavan's presence on the altar, how will you have his experience elsewhere? Make sense? If you're unable to really feel Bhagavan's presence here on an altar, then what chance do you have of finding Bhagavan anywhere else? So it's like steps. We start by the experience of Bhagavan in some more physical manifestation, like a deity on the altar, and we move beyond that. But ultimately, Bhagavan is, we're talking Mukhya Bhakti. We're going to come to the Gauni Bhakti in a moment, but in Mukhya Bhakti, Bhagavan is here now, available for your experience. And that's exactly what the next sutra says. Tat prapya, tat prapya, tadevavalokayati, tadevavalokayati, tadevashrinoti, tadevachintayati, tat prapya, having gained that, having gained that parabhakti, having gained that Bhagavan, having discovered God's presence here, now, then what? Tat eva, that alone, avalokayati, one sees, one would see. Having discovered Bhagavan, to paraphrase, having discovered Bhagavan, one sees only Bhagavan. One sees only God. Tadeva shrinoti, one hears only Bhagavan. Tadeva chintayati, one thinks only of Bhagavan. Please don't take a very shallow meaning here of somebody who's like obsessed emotionally. It's all they can think about, all they can talk about. We're talking about one who recognizes sarvam kalvidam brahma. All this is nothing but Bhagavan. With that recognition, then everything they experience is that God. There's one famous story, and I forget what, I'm not sure if this is a story associated with Guru Nanak or some great saint who was sleeping with his feet toward, there are several variations of this story. And the one that's in my head, I think is actually a Sufi telling or some, because, it's his feet were in a direction of Kaaba, of Mecca. And he was told, you can't put your feet in that direction. And he says, well, so if I put my feet in this direction, that's also a direction of Bhagavan. I put my feet in that direction, it's also Bhagavan. There's another great, I think the Hindu version of this is the Rishi put his feet on a linga, a Shiva linga underneath a tree. And then some passerby saw this saint sitting, laying down with his feet propped up on this sacred form. And asked him, how can you can't have your feet on that sacred form. And he said, okay, well, if you think that's not right, please move my feet someplace else where Bhagavan is not. So the passerby took his feet and put them to the side. And as he put those feet down, another linga popped up, perhaps out of the ground. And then, then he took the legs or the feet and tried to put them over here. And as he's putting them down, wherever he attempted to put those feet, another Shivalinga apparently sprouted out of the ground. What saint is the story associated with? Does anyone know? It's usually told with regard to one particular saint. I don't happen to remember whom. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference anyway. So nice story. This is what it means to tadeva chintayati, tadeva shrinoti, tadeva avalokayati. Everything you see, you recognize this is Bhagavan. Everything you hear, everything you experience, and not only what you experience out there, here's a challenging one, what you experience in here also. When the Rishi said, Sarvam kalvidam brahma,
all this is nothing but Bhagavan. Obviously, it's a statement of the essential divinity of all that exists. When we look around us in the world, and we see nature, see trees and forests and beautiful mountains and streams, pretty easy to see, that's nature. Bhagavan is present. God's divinity is present. But the HIV virus is also Bhagavan's presence, is it not? The HIV virus is a terrible killer. But it means Bhagavan is present in all forms. Whether they're forms you like or not, they're natural. HIV is, in a sense, natural. It's nature. Everything is nature. Some aspects of nature we find threatening, we find harmful, and we want to and we must avoid. But it is still part of the whole, part of Bhagavan's manifestation. So, everything out here, outside, desirable and undesirable, is part of Bhagavan's sacred creation, his sacred manifestation. Wouldn't that apply inside as well? Which means you have emotions of being loving and kind and happy and compassionate. Wonderful, Bhagavan's divinity. What about those days when you're a little angry, you're a little irritable, you're a little frustrated, and you're not doing so well? Well, if the good emotions, the compassion and love, are Bhagavan's sacred manifestation, isn't it equally true that the anger and frustration is also Bhagavan's sacred presence? This is the ultimate vision of the rishis. When they said sarvam kalvidam brahma, sarvam means everything, they didn't mean everything except the HIV virus. They didn't mean everything except your anger and frustration. Everything means everything. They meant it. All right. So, the one who has gained mukhya bhakti, mukhya means primary. One who has gained the mukhya bhakti, primary bhakti, is one who, tat prapya, having attained that, then what? Tadeva avalokayati. That person sees nothing but Bhagavan. Tadeva shrinoti. That person hears nothing but Bhagavan. Tadeva chintayati. That person thinks nothing but Bhagavan. Everything being nothing but Bhagavan. So that describes then the mukhya bhakti. In the 56th sutra, we begin talking about the gauni bhakti, the secondary bhakti. Gauni tridha, gauni trid, guna bhedad, guna artadi bhedad va. So this secondary bhakti, gauni, is tridha, threefold. Here's our classification. So what are these three kinds of secondary bhakti? He says, guna bhedat. According to the bheda, according to the differences of guna. Hey, we know something about gunas. We know something about the fact that there are three gunas. Like he says, tridha means of three forms. So what are those three gunas? Let me stay with all Roman characters here. So we'll start tamas, sattva, rajas, and sattva. And I'm doing it in a reverse order for a reason. Tamas, or tamoguna, is the quality of inertia, of darkness, of lethargy, of ignorance. Rajas, rajoguna, is a quality of activity, of energy, of passion, of desire. Sattva, sattva-guna, can best be described as the absence of the other two. In the absence of tamas, in the absence of rajas, what's left is a condition of purity, untouched by tamas or rajas. So, sattva-guna. So here he says that
this Gauni bhakti, the secondary bhakti, is tridha, three kinds, and it can be described in terms of these three gunas, tamas, rajas, and sattva. But he says there's another way of understanding classification. He says, artari bhedat va, or it is bhedat because of the bheda, the distinctions. What kind of distinctions? The distinctions called artari. And that expression, artha, etc., adi here means etc., artha, etc. Where have you heard that word, artha? It's not a very common word. It does, however, occur exactly once in the Bhagavad Gita, which is the only place I can think of it. In the 7th chapter, Sri Krishna says, Chaturvidha bhajante mam jana sukrati norjuna. Artha jignasu artharti jnani cha bharatarshabha. If you want to look it up, it is verse 16, chapter 7, verse 16. And it says, I'll just paraphrase it, chaturvidha, four kinds of bhaktas, janaha, four kinds of people, who are sukratinaha, good people, people who do good things. There are four kinds of people, bhajante, who worship mam, me. Arjuna, there are four kinds of people who worship me. And he lists in the second half of the verse, what are those four kinds of people? He says, artha jignasuhu artharti jnani cha bharatarshabha. Four, chaturvidha. Of course, here we have three. Now he's giving four. We have to resolve this three and four business, but we will. And we actually find a correspondence. Very nice correspondence. So Sri Krishna talks about four kinds of bhaktas. First he calls an artha. Who is the artha? The artha is a person who only prays in times of distress. When things are absolutely miserable, this person has gone into a temple once in the last 10 years, and it was on the worst day of that person's life. It takes a horrible tragedy to bring this person to the brink of prayer. This is the artha. Then he talks about the artharti. Artharti. The artharti is another bhakti, bhakta, another devotee. This is the one who worships when they need some help. Their bank account is in bad shape, or some investment is going belly up, or some problem, and they pray, "Hey Bhagavan, please help me with this. Please give me this. Please grant me this. Give me, give me, give me." That's what artharti means. Artin, one who seeks. One who seeks what? Artha, some goal, something. So someone seeking. So the artha is one who prays in distress. The artharti is one who prays for a specific goal. And the next of the four is the jignasu. Most of you know the word jignasu means one who wants to know. And specifically, the one who wants to know God, Bhagavan, the one who seeks Bhagavan, the one who's praying to come closer to Bhagavan. So jignasu, seeking to know God. So, do you think there's a relationship here between these three? Looks like a pretty clear pattern. you know, this tamoguna, the lowest of the three gunas, it's a, you know, kind of the base personality of people. There are poorest qualities. So someone whose mind is ruled by lethargy, by ignorance, by delusion, this is a person who generally is not going to pray. But in a crisis, that person might be driven to pray, and then they would pray only at the time of distress. So we would say then that the artha is a devotee who only prays in times of distress. Why? Their minds are ruled by tamas. The artharthi is one who prays taking God's blessings to gain worldly ends. Notice the artharthi is one who prays only for worldly things. Of course, worldly things includes good things like health and so forth, but they're all worldly goals. Good health, money, enjoyment, family, children, etc., etc. The list goes on endlessly. Puja Swami Dayananda always joked that the artharthi is one who takes Bhagavan as a business partner. Because you want him to, really. In fact, not only is it a business part, there's even in any business, there's a contract, I suppose. In business, right, you make a contract. So how does the artharthi pray? Hey, Bhagavan, if you give me this, I promise to do that. There's a contract. The person says, if you answer my prayers, I promise I'll put $1,000 in the hundi, or I'll do this, or I'll do that. And they make these vows. It's like a contract, taking Bhagavan as a business partner. Well, that certainly is rajasic. This is rajoguna. This is the element of desire, of seeking, of wanting to fulfill our desires and wishes. So this is rajas. So the artharthi then is one who takes Bhagavan as a business partner, so to speak, one who wants God's blessings for the sake of gaining worldly ends. Clearly, there are people driven by rajas. And the third category here is the jignasu whose prayer is, hey, Bhagavan, I really want to be freed from my confusion. I want to recognize your presence here now in everything all the time. The jignasu is one who is ultimately seeking God, not seeking worldly things as the artharthi is, and not seeking freedom from some worldly problem as the artha is. So the jignasu then is the sattvika, the very pure of the three. Mind is free from tamas. Mind is free from rajas. Therefore, sattva. So how nicely it ties together. He says, tridha, this gauni bhakti, this secondary bhakti, is tridha in these three ways, sattva, rajas, tamas, or chaturdha, fourfold. Hey, how do you fit three and four? So Sri Krishna said there were four kinds of bhaktas. Well, before we answer that, let's finish this up. Sri Krishna in chapter 7 says there's four kinds of bhaktas. Well, what happened to the fourth? The fourth he calls jnani. Jnani is the one who is enlightened, the one who has discovered Bhagavan. Well, the one who has discovered Bhagavan is the one who sees Bhagavan everywhere, who hears Bhagavan everywhere, who has Bhagavan in every thought. Isn't that the mukhya bhakta that we're just talking about? So that's where the fourth of the four in the Bhagavad Gita, the jnani, is not one of the three, because these three are part of gauni bhakti. This fourth, the bhakti of the jnani, is not one of the three, but it's up here in another category with the mukhya bhakti. Now, before we move on. This verse is commonly quoted. It's also, like many verses, it can be misconstrued. In this verse,
is Sri Krishna putting down those who pray only in times of distress? Is he putting down those who pray only for worldly goals and ends? He's not putting them down. He's actually praising them. In the next verse, he's going to say the jnani is the best of the four. He's going to say that in the next verse. But in this verse, verse 16, I guess, he's not putting them down. We could say at least that Artha is praying. Many people in a time of distress, they don't go to the temple, they go to the bar. At least if his fellow goes to the temple, if his person prays, well, that's good. And same for the Artarti. At least they're recognizing that their success in worldly ventures depends on God's grace. This is good. If you say, yes, but these are lower forms, absolutely. And that's what the next two sutras are going to talk about, that these are like steps in a sequence. It's like climbing a ladder, and there are steps. You can't jump to the top. If you want to cross a river, and a river is 20 or 30 feet wide, can you jump? Can you jump that far? Suppose there are stepping stones. You jump from one stone to the next, from that stone to the next. And these different forms of bhakti are set up like stepping stones. Let's proceed and you'll see exactly how that works. In the 57th sutra. Uttrasmat, uttrasmat. Purva purva shreyaya bhavati. Uttrasmat. Than the prior one. Uttrasmat, uttrasmat. Better than the prior one. Than the prior one. Purva purvaha. The ones following. Uttrasmat, uttrasmat. With reference to the prior ones. I'm sorry. With reference to the latter ones. Let me get it in the right order. Uttrasmat, uttrasmat. With reference to the latter ones, compared to the latter ones. Purva, purvaha. The prior ones are shreyaya, for the sake of gaining that one. Bhavati, shreyaya. For the sake of shreyas, for the sake of that which is best. In fact, shreyas here can mean mukhya bhakti. What it says, and just to paraphrase this, a little bit of technical language, what it says is that the prior ones are for the sake of attaining the latter ones, and they're all for the sake of gaining mukhya bhakti. So how can we understand this? What are the prior ones? Where shall we start? Well, let's start with tamas. We'll start with the Artha, the one who prays in distress. Suppose we say, again, we're not putting the person down, but can we say they're at like the first rung of the ladder, so to speak? And then we come to the Artarti, the one driven by rajas. And again, we're not putting them down. After all, they've climbed to the second rung of the ladder. Then we can come to the Jignasu, being freed from tamas and rajas, they're very sattvika, they're very pure in their attitude. They've climbed to the third rung of the ladder, but that's not the top yet. So the next step of this ladder is then what? The jnani. This is the mukhya bhakti, that would be the next step. So therefore, uttrasmat, uttrasmat. You know, ladder. Purva, purvaha. The prior ones. I'm sorry, I get my language all mixed up here. Uttrasmat, uttrasmat. Than the latter ones. Purva, purvaha. All the prior ones. Shreyaya bhavati. Are for the sake of that which is best. For the sake of climbing that ladder. So each, in this succession, each one leads to the next, and then what?
Anyasmat, anyas, saulabhyam bhaktau, saulabhyam bhaktau.
Why do we have this succession? Why can't we just go to mukhya bhakti? Why do we need all of these steps? You can't jump across that river in one jump. You can't get to the top of the building in one jump. We go step by step. There's a method, there's a sequence in almost any aspect of life. So he says, anyasmat, compared to the other one. The other one here means mukhya bhakti. Anya here means mukhya bhakti. Anyasmat, compared to the other one, compared to mukhya bhakti, saulabhyam bhaktau. Bhaktau, with reference to this bhakti, these others are saulabhyam, easier, more accessible. So you start at what's most accessible. What's most accessible? The first step. When you're on the first step, then what's most accessible? The second step. When you're on the second step, then you can reach the third. It's a sequence like that. We find a lot of teachings that build sequentially here. Now, this is a nice point to see more succession and more classification building on one another. Just as we see sadhana bhakti, and this isn't in the text, but this should be brought in at some point in our discussion, and this looks like the right place to bring it in. And this will be the last topic for tonight. So we see sadhana bhakti distinguished as mukhya. Oops. Sadhana bhakti as mukhya primary and gauni secondary, where the mukhya bhakti is a goal and the gauni is the primary means, and the gauni is the secondary means. Then we saw this threefold division of the secondary bhakti into bhakti driven by tamas, rajas, and sattva, or the bhakti of the artha, the artarti, and the jignyasu. Well, do you think this would have further classifications? Five. Oh, this is a little bit like a botany class where one thing gets subdivided into that and that gets subdivided into these get subdivided into others. We can say the one with a pure heart, the sattvika one, is one who wants to know God, one who starts to develop a personal relationship with that God. One of the big questions we haven't spent enough time talking about, we've talked a lot about the goal being a condition of union or discovering one's non-separation from Bhagavan. And we've talked relatively little about how to get there. Well, we're starting to get some idea. How to get there? Well, here's a good starting point, but don't stop there. Proceed from being an artha to an artarti, but don't stop there. Proceed to being jignyasu. Don't even stop there. Here we need maybe a few more steps. How about if you're climbing a ladder? And there's one step that's a little too long, then we need to fill in a few more steps. So perhaps we can take these five, so to speak, filling in this gap so that we have a way to climb further. Actually, this is a big topic. We'll just introduce it here tonight because it's not the right time to get into a new topic here. Let's introduce it tonight. And then we'll see it in more detail in the next class. At least we'll see it in context here in this hierarchy or structure. five kinds of bhaktas who want to know God very personally, and they do so by developing a personal relationship with Bhagavan. And we'll identify those five. We'll just only identify them tonight, and then we'll talk about them much more in our next class. Five forms of bhakti as practiced by this one, by that jignyasu. First form, and I'll stay again with all Roman letters for now, is called shanta bhakti. Shanta means quiet, peaceful, peaceful. Shanta, peace of peaceful form of bhakti. I'm going to get the order right. There's a krama, there's a sequence here. So, peaceful. Next is called dasya. It's the attitude of being related to Lord as his servant. We've talked a little bit about this before. We'll return to this again in our next class. First attitude is a peaceful relationship with Bhagavan. Simple. Second is that of a dasa, of a servant, dasya. The third is called sakya. It's the attitude of taking Bhagavan as a friend, as an associate, as someone who's always with you, so to speak. Then the fourth, vatsalya, it's hard to come up with one word here. How about tenderness? Vatsalya is usually described as the attitude of a parent towards a child. That kind of tenderness, of wanting to help, of wanting to do what's right, of wanting to make the other happy. So that kind of tenderness. And then the final of the five, madhurya. Literally it means sweetness, but that means nothing here. Madhurya is best described as the feeling between lovers, looking upon Bhagavan as your beloved. If vatsalya is looking upon Bhagavan as somebody that you're very tenderly related to, then madhurya is looking upon Bhagavan as somebody to whom you're very intimately connected. Now, we're not going to, we should spend some time talking about this tradition of looking at bhakti in terms of these five relationships. It's a big topic, so we'll save it for the next class. But look at it in context. Here we've got more rungs, so to speak. And they are like rungs. So starting here with the artha, proceeding the artarti, the jignyasu, and then even among jignyasus, you can see these as rungs, as steps. Steps of increasing intimacy with Bhagavan, culminating in a discovery of one's non-separation. And we'll have to see that more in the next class. And this actually relates to, there was a question in our question basket, and it was, how can we compare the bhakti of the gopis in Vraja to the enlightenment that we've been talking about? And I think we'll wait in the next class, because the attitude of the gopis is this one. So maybe we'll set the question aside for the next class, and we'll be able to take that up when we discuss this madhurya bhava. So we can call these bhavas an attitude or a condition. So shanta bhava is having a peaceful attitude towards Bhagavan. Dasya bhava is looking upon God as master and yourself as servant. Sakya bhava
is looking upon Bhagavan as one who's with you on the path of life, a friend, so to speak. Vatsalya Bhava is looking upon Bhagavan as one with whom you're very tender, a tender relationship. Madhurya Bhava, looking upon Bhagavan as one with whom you have a very intimate, close relationship. So we'll see these more in the next class, and we'll continue with the next series of sutras. A couple of quick announcements here at the end of the class. This coming Friday is the fifth Friday, so we have no program here on the fifth Friday. The following Friday is the first Friday where we have our guest lecture. And you might be quite interested in the guest lecture for January 5th.